What's up, everybody? It's Austin Rivers from the Minnesota Timberwolves. It's a new year, and I have a new podcast here at The Ringer, Off Guard, hosted by me and my guy, Pasha Hagigi.
Austin and I go way back and talk so much hoop already that we figured it was time to fire up the mics and let you in on all of these conversations.
Every week, Pasha and I will hit on the biggest stories happening in the league
and get Austin's perspective of someone currently hooping in the NBA.
Tap into Off Guard every Friday on The Ringer NBA show feed on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln in the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, he just liquidated his winery for Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. It's Andy Greenwald.
It's the least I can do for Francis after all he's done for me.
This is my last pod because I'm joining Megalopolis as the art director.
What I said to you when you pointed this out to me, and for people who aren't following the news, for people who don't have the word Megalopolis in their Google alert
search, it's hard
search,
for me
like
to pronounce
Chris does.
That word, much like archipelago.
No, it's fine. It's all part of the word salad that is our life. Our guy, Frankie C., Francis mm-hmm. Ford Coppola, has poured his own fortune into a science fiction film that he is currently lensing in outside of Atlanta, like all science fiction films. And there was just some reports of some strife and like the entire art department quitting and the special effects team quitting and everyone quitting. And so my thing about this is...
Do you know what the best shit about that though was?
What's that?
Adam Driver like called Deadline to basically be like, I've been on some bad sets. And it was like kind of obvious. It was like Rise of Skywalker. And he was like, and this isn't a bad set.
He called Deadline, like 1-800
Deadline. It's in the Mike Fleming blog post about this movie. And it's like Coppola being like, look, sometimes the entire art department and VFX team quit or I fire them. And that's just the way it goes. But we're on budget and it's going to be done next year. And then there's also like one person who took issue with like the characterization of this as a runaway apocalypse now, you know, nightmare train was Adam Driver, who chimed in with this paragraph long statement.
Local man speaks up in defense of elderly director. I mean, my only thing is it's shocking because, you know, collectively we have no historical record of what happens when Francis Ford Coppola is just given a blank check. Like, you know what I mean? Like historically that's never been a problem.
No, he's always worked on really strict budgets and on really strict schedules.
And honestly, that stuff only gets better in your 80s. It's like holding on to classified documents. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
It's just like the older you get, the more like razor sharp you are about what's in front of you and what you're doing. Right?
I just laugh because I'm like, oh yeah, like my mom is in her 80s and just imagining her directing Megalopolis. But then it hits me that like she's also Joe Biden's age.
Or my dad being president. Yeah. No, I don't see no notes. I like... I just look forward to a robust campaign season.
This is a little bit of a grab bag episode, right? Because we were sort of casting around looking for something to watch for this week. And I think I found something, but I can't in good conscience make you watch another Scottish ensemble show. So to all those people who are waiting for my thoughts on The Rig on Amazon Prime, which is about a environmental disaster striking a oil drilling rig in the North Sea. I like it. It's real good.
Oh, well, you know what? I can meet you here because I'm sure many, many, many listeners, people are coming up to me on the street and they're saying, sir, when are we going to get your thoughts on the latest series from the French creator of Call My Agent about a young multiracial cast of up-and-coming stand-up comedians in the Paris summertime called Standing Up? And I'm here to tell you, Chris, that it is definitely, definitely a show about up-and-coming Parisian stand-up comics in the summertime.
What streaming
100%.
Is that Netflix?
That is on Netflix. And boy, yeah, I really enjoyed seeing Paris in the summertime.
So did you fire that up last night?
I fired it up the other night. You know, now I'm leaning into it. My viewing habits are completely opaque to you. You will never know what I'm watching or when I'm watching it.
After 11 years, we need to keep things spicy here, right?
It's time. This is how we... Yes, the other podcast I did listen to was Dan Savage on the Ezra Klein Show talking about how to keep things interesting in the bedroom, and maybe they means the Zoom room also. So I'm taking some keys. I'm taking something from that playbook.
Yeah. If things are getting a little vanilla in bed, try investing all your money in a sci-fi utopian vision.
Why not? Adam Driver will call you. That would have been one of the things on the Kickstarter if Francis Ford Coppola hadn't just like sold the winery. And do you feel like Sophia was like, just give me the shares of the sparkling? Like, you know what I mean? Like Marie-Anne Tounette isn't going to pay for itself. Do you feel like people like Fanny Herrero, who created Call My Agent, a really charming show that I really enjoyed watching and was hoping that she would strike gold again with this. Uh-huh. Do you think they're like no, I want to say.
How many episodes did you watch?
Two, but it's hard. There's a reason why shows about stand-up comedy don't often do well. It's because you have to write funny stand-up comedy. And then also there literally are no stakes. I mean, I understand.
Yeah.
If you're a devoted fan of the first 12 minutes of the WTF podcast, maybe the stakes feel a little more like lived in. But beyond that, it's really not that stakesy. So no, but I do feel like the name of the show in France, like so Call My Agent in France is called 10%, you know, which I kind of like. Like, that's what the agents take. Call My Agent. Okay. This show is called Troll. Funny. It's just called Funny. But then the bright boys in the back of Netflix are like, we'll call it Standing Up because they're stand-ups.
Right.
You know what I mean? I got nothing else to say about the show. Paris looks great.
I feel the same. I mean, like, I've been watching this show, The Rig. It's created by David McPherson. It stars everybody who dies on Game of Thrones and Line of Duty. I think that's the best way of putting it.
Great.
And it's just super entertaining. I kind of wish that there were more shows like this made in the States. It's 6-episode thriller, but it's on Amazon Prime. I'm just biding my time until Last of Us comes out. So I'm enjoying myself with that. We wanted to hit a bunch of different things today, though. There's I think one of the things about the Golden Globes is it really lingers in the mind. You know, it really... I think it's like, it's not one of those like sort of channel surfing TikTok attention span things. It really like is an award show that demands waiting a few days, thinking about it, considering what you want to say about it. So we're going to weigh in on the Golden Globes 48 hours later. We're also
going to
chat.
What a heavy footprint on the culture, you know?
Yeah.
Really?
A little bit about Rachel Syme's Bella Bajaria profile in The New Yorker. So this is being passed around quite a bit on social media.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Joe Nocicella's latest dance review.
We
can
do
New Yorker.
That too.
Oh no, I've really, really done a poor job preparing for this.
Can I ask you a question just between the two of us after podcasting for 11 years?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, because one thing I've noticed about you recently is you've been starting a lot of shows and you do it for me and you do it for you. But do we need to invent a new character for you where you grow a mustache and it's Dennis Eckersley, Andy, and it's the closer who comes and finishes shows?
Yes.
Don't you want to know what happens in Copenhagen Cowboy or Rogue Heroes?
Oh, you're doing this for me.
Yeah. I'm just curious.
I'm impressed that you're still curious, Chris. Like, I guess this is the time on our 11th anniversary to just announce that I don't think I'm curious anymore. I'm okay with mystery.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I thought you were going to say that, like, I could do a bit on a podcast where I just watch the last 2 hours of Sons of Anarchy and just cook. You know what I mean?
And just, and you're just like, clearly the problem with the show is this.
Yeah. Like, let me break it down and diagnose what happened here.
You probably
could do that.
Good.
But so you're a completist. You're a completist. Like, when you read a book by an author you like, do you still, even at our advanced age, do you feel the need to read all the books by that author? Like, do you need to do that?
Oh, I don't feel like, I don't need to be a completist when it comes to individual authors. Okay. With filmmakers, I try to be pretty completist, like when I'm talking about them. Like I try to have seen all their work relatively recently.
What a burn on me. What a subtweet.
With shows.
Yeah.
It's actually funny. It's the same thing with when you're reading a novel and you have in that in your mind, there is the amount of time I've spent reading this thing, I need to be able to look myself in the mirror and say I finished it. And 100%. That's how I feel about TV shows. So once you get past episode 2 or 3 of something, it's like, what am I going to just have been like, I watched 4 hours of this show, but decided not to watch the last 4 hours.
Was that me, but movie phone? Maybe I should just tell you what happened at the end of Copenhagen Cowboy. That is what you guys did. For the record, we talked a lot with Sean on Monday about the new Netflix series. I was going to say Nicholas Winding Refn's new Netflix series. I think we can all say his last Netflix series, Copenhagen Cowboy. And I really liked it. And spoiler, I liked it more than anybody else on the podcast, having not finished it. I think so. Sean was weirdly...
He was just like, I want Nick to make a real movie, which is like a very Sean thing to say. It's a Sean demand.
I just feel like for people who skip that podcast because they aren't interested, I would advocate give it a shot. I really did enjoy it. But sure. I would also say, and I mean the podcast, don't watch the show. I just thought our podcast, we triumphed over.
We need the listens.
We really do. No, it's just that we'd agreed before we recorded that because you guys had finished that I would hop off the call before you started spoiling. And like within 45 seconds, you said, I'm not going to do it again. But you were like, well, here's what the show's actually about.
I meant that like more like universally, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. We have the Globes. We have this Bella Bajaria profile, which I think we don't have to, I'm not going to spoil Rachel Syme's year long reporting, but we can talk a little bit about some of the learnings we've taken from that. And then we have
go ahead.
Just the Ant-Man trailer.
Ant-Man trailer, but then at the end, I do have a Daddington thing I would like to talk to you
about. Of course, man. But 50% your podcast. If you want to dictate, let me tell you something. Year 11. Yeah. Should you start hosting?
Year 11? No. I also think that, you know, per the addendum to my contract that Daniel X sent me at EOY, that is not 50%. It is not 50% mine. It's been brought to my attention that it is not. Yeah. But I'm lucky to be here. Let's run through those things. Let's do Globes and Ant-Man because those are pressing cultural issues.
For some reason, this felt like I hadn't seen an award show in 25 years. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it was kind of like smoking pot for the first time. I guess there's two sort of separate tracks we could cover here. There's Gerard Carmichael, who we're great admirers of as a host. Yeah. And I think also what Gerard Carmichael's, point of view, what that meant to the show and how it set the tone, but also like, what's the role of a host, which weirdly you and I have come back to over and over again, as we've kind of talked about these award shows over the years. We don't need to belabor it because obviously the HFPA is just an opaque and weird organization. And these awards don't truly impact the real like awards of the Oscars. I think they can develop some momentum. And if somebody gives a great speech, it might be like, hey, like, you know, this guy has really thrown his hat in the ring or whatever. But Sean and Amanda did a great job sort of breaking down all the like, did this matter? Did this not matter? What does this mean going forward stuff? I thought the most interesting thing that they brought up was Michelle Yeoh being kind of like, very obviously kind of being like, I probably won't be Cate Blanchett. So this is my awards acceptance speech and like kind of doing the thing. But, you know, I was curious where you want to start? You want to start with like who won or who hosted?
No. Let's do big picture, and then, I mean, literally, you be Sean, I'll be Amanda. Let's do it. Let's cosplay. I think Sean, I mean, he always makes very good points, but one of the really good points he made on this show was that the industry, if not the culture, does kind of need an award show in this spot. Like, it does make sense to help sort of focus the mind in terms of where we are, what people have liked, what they haven't liked, what new things could come across our radar. And I mean that both for movies and TV, and also to sort of focus the Oscar race now that everything has become diffuse. Everything is either streaming or not, and there is no narrative anymore. So in that sense, like, something should go in this spot, and it was weird last year for there not to be, and I think I agree with him. I also think that the Golden Globes is so uniquely not suited to be the show that it feels it must become given what happened over the last 2 years. Like, the Golden Globes' reputation was that it was a silly party, right? And that's what made it good. And then someone was just like, your silly party looks like the Black Klansman that isn't black. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like the other ones. Like, it's just foreign white people in a room that I picture as like Snoke's throne room from The Last Jedi. Like, that is what I imagine the voting chamber looks like.
Right.
And so then they had to be like, we're sorry. We're going to do better. We're going to performatively fix this. And you know what? I don't even need to be that cynical and jaded. Maybe there's an element to it that's not performative. Like, more inclusion, more diversity. This is broadly good. It's good for any workplace, and it's good for any organization, and it's also good for the product, for the award shows, to be looking at different performers, to be looking at different films, welcoming them into the party. So I do think that's important to say. But it did put the Golden Globes in such a bizarre, impossible pickle where the light, silly show that everyone knows doesn't matter, but we're here for larger career-driven or entertainment-driven purposes, had to be something more than that. And it kind of tripped on itself because of that. So I laugh knowingly at your observation that it had been 25 years since we had seen one, because I kind of felt that too. But I also felt like it had been many, many years since I had seen one this atonal. You know, just like, and we're only in hour three, you know?
How much do you think that's down to Carmichael, and how much is it down to just like everybody getting up on stage after Carmichael's speech and being like, thank you so much to the Hollywood Foreign Press?
But it also was this weird mix of styles, and like the best moment to me by far
was Zelensky.
Was Zelensky, because, you know, the only Hollywood Foreign President I recognize is Vladimir. Is he going to go into the SAGs when they go on Netflix next year?
Do you think he goes to the ESPYs is my question.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
Yeah.
The Bobby V Award?
Is that Jimmy V?
Bobby Valentine? No, the Bobby Valentine Award for wearing a fake mustache in a war zone. It's the key to podcasting. I've learned it in the second decade. You just keep talking. There are no mistakes. You just keep the tape rolling, Kaya. Turn all the cameras on. The best moment of this year's Golden Globes for me was Regina Hall reading why Kevin Costner wasn't there.
Yes.
And it was like, we stand with Santa Barbara. Like, that was so funny. And look, again, appropriate bracketed disclosure. The weather here is gnarly and terrifying and dangerous, and it sucked. And there's been real flooding and loss of life and loss of property.
I had flooding on my street, I'll have you know. I was basically an auxiliary member of the Dutton family. I was like out. I told you what I did, right? Like,
yes.
There was like a flash flood on my street. I had to move my wife's Mini.
You did tell me. Do you want to talk about how you hulked out?
No, I didn't hulk out.
Did you move it with your arms?
But I went out. I actually just told this story on Rewatchable, so I feel like I'm repeating myself. But like like the water came up to my
the re-listenables now
of my legs, and I was like, "This is really like, I honestly hope there's life after death, so that I can still hear how Andy has to pay tribute to me tearfully when I'm like was washed away on like the only street in Los Feliz that flash flooded."
Were you like, "This truly is the way of water," and then you then you turned to the camera and dove in. It was everything that was wrong about this award show, but also kind of everything that was right about what it could have been, which is to say, I'm sure Kevin Costner had trouble getting on a private plane or an automobile to go to this award show.
Yeah. I can tell you, it sucks to take the grapevine at this time of year.
1,000,000%. Yeah. I think it's also worth saying he didn't give a shit, because this is pretend. You know, this is pretend in a deeper way than it was before. And that was kind of pervasive. So there was that element of we cannot let people in on the joke anymore, you know, because then the whole thing will fall apart. Like, the stakes were weirdly high for this as an idea, because NBC's contract is up. So this was basically an audition for it to continue to exist, because the Hollywood Foreign Press does not just throw this party on its own. It throws it due to the largesse of the NBC, Universal, Comcast, Shinehart wig company wanting to put the party on TV every year. And with the ratings what they are, this is what the lowest rated, the second lowest rated, 6 million people tuned in for it. It just felt like a mess to me.
I make that ESPYs joke, but they also picked the night that there was no football. Like, they purposely moved it.
Intentionally, yeah.
They
tried to pick their spot. That doesn't work.
You know, you mentioned the how funny the Regina Hall moment was. I'm trying to think of like the funniest things that I've ever seen or experienced. You know, it's like the first 600 times you do the Borat my wife thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of Curb moments, Bill Murray moments that I can think of, but
Chris, just so you know, the middle 600 times you do it, not funny.
Then it comes back around.
It becomes so funny again.
Do you know what might be number one right now?
What's that?
Is Miguel Sapochnik accepting for House of the Dragon.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. This was really the only thing I wanted to talk about.
So they're for two reasons. And those two reasons are Emma Darcy and Millie Alcock were the only two people who went up on stage with him when he accepted for Best Drama. Mm-hmm. And he no longer works on House of the Dragon. He left. You can read Matt Bellany's reporting about what happened there. It was essentially like a disagreement about the role of his wife on the show, or reportedly that was the story behind this. But he accepted on behalf of, I guess, everybody or whatever, and didn't thank Ryan Condal, didn't thank George Martin.
Nope.
And then I was watching him and he was just like, and you know, when we premiered this show, there was just such a sigh of relief because it was walking in the footsteps of such a great achievement, which was Game of Thrones. And I was like, that's way to pay it forward, brother, man. That's really cool. And then I was like, oh yeah, you directed Game of Thrones.
It was a legendary shitlord performance, like one for the ages, one that has almost turned me entirely around on him and House of the Dragon. Like, it was amazing. And let's really go through it, right? Because first of all, you don't need me to be the voice saying that it is Clown Town that show won Best Drama Television Series of the Year. Like, I feel like even the show's most passionate defenders would struggle making that argument.
I don't know that the people who made House of the Dragon thought that. Like, I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
Like, there was nobody there. Like, there's like 12 people on stage for White Lotus.
They didn't think they were going to win. There's also that piece of like, I'm not going to the Golden Globes because that's not a real thing anymore, especially because we're not going to win. Miguel Sapochnik was like, I'll go and I won't get dressed up. I mean, he was dressed up.
He just didn't tuck his shirt in and he was wearing white sneakers.
He dressed up like we dress up to host FYC events in that same room. You know what I mean? Like he Hollywood.
I stopped doing that now. Not FYC events, but I stopped dressing up. I'm like, it's ODB up here. Like it's just uncut raw CR.
You stopped dressing up for anything or for like hosting and moderating events?
I guess that's not true. It's not like I show up wearing like a fucking Liverpool tracksuit, but like I don't like pretend that I wear blazers. You know what I mean?
I was just reading this article about the head of security for the number one seed in the NFC, Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up.
He wears, excuse me, what role are you playing on this podcast? Sean's role? He just like holding space for Jets fans? Just that the guy says that he dresses in South Philly tuxedos, which are velour tracksuits, which I really liked. Well, look, he was taking cues from GQ for CR, and just the entitlement of like, I guess we're just going to have a go at this live thank you speech was just wild. So you have the two performers who play the same character at different ages, just sort of gently pawing each other in a show of solidarity behind him. And the rest of the people working on the show, presumably
are working on the show.
Just like it's 4 a.m. in Belfast and like ping pong balls dressed as dragons are raining down on them. You know what I mean? Including Ryan Condal, who did co-create the show, who is the showrunner of the show and moved his family to the UK to make the show. And then the show wins Best Series and he doesn't even get mentioned. It's wild. It's wild, right? Like, I'm just trying to think of like who... There aren't many opportunities for people who no longer work for a company showing up to represent the company.
It's true. I think he has like an overall deal with HBO. I think he's still part of the family.
Okay. So it's not like Bill going to the ESPYs.
Right. Exactly.
And being like, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. I get it. But it was just, I loved it. I loved it. It was so crazy. And it was crazy in a way that the Golden Globes should be crazy. You know, that's the thing. We can go through the winners and losers. And broadly, I feel like the same way that I felt on Monday, which is when people who I think are deserving win a trophy, I'm glad for them. I think that's broadly good for them and they're happy. And maybe it does build into a narrative that these are projects worth paying attention to, that are worthy, that, you know, could get other awards. I did think though, again, they're just ending up in this mushy middle where it's like, if you're going to be different, fucking be different. Give the Best Picture give the Best Picture Globe to Top Gun. Give it to Black Panther too. Just be legends. You know what I mean? Don't just be like, well, The Fabelmans is nice.
What do you think would have happened if Top Gun had won without Tom Cruise there, but also after the Shelley Miscavige joke?
What do I think would have happened?
Well, not what would have happened, but like it was awkward enough that he did Gerard Carmichael did the joke about Shelley Miscavige after, and like then Glenn Powell and Jay Ellis had to come out and be like, Tom Cruise is a great boss.
I appreciate Gerard Carmichael. You know, I think there's a way where if you squint, The Way of Water is about Sea Org.
Sure.
You know, in all the brave people we've lost along the way. So, but do you get the broader point? Do you get what I mean? Like, it just has never made sense to me for the Golden Globes to be like, no, really, take us seriously. We're just as viable as the Oscars or Emmys.
No,
I be think the silly I drunk Mike party. White's, be the chaos agent.
Yeah, Mike White was like, that's what I want from the Golden Globes, is Mike White being like, they stopped serving food when I got here and I've just been drinking white wine for 3 hours. And now I'm up here crying about Jennifer Coolidge and trying to speak Italian. That's what I want. I thought that a lot of the show actually like, it was too long. Feel like I've made this comment before about like they need to do two Emmys a year, but maybe they should just do not Hollywood Foreign Press Association like advocacy on my part here, but maybe the Globes should just be a TV Globes and a movie Globes and you do it at different times of the year or something like that. But yeah, I feel like the sort of mishmash of TV and film winds up being like kind of a slog, and if you skip the TV part, then maybe you can skip the Ryan Murphy part.
Yes, I mean I agree with you. I think that's a tough argument to make when it's getting 6 million viewers that they need more award shows. But I do agree with you. I mean, I think that this just also leads into the kind of essentially schizophrenic nature of the project, right? Because the TV and movie aspects of it, absolutely, if you just take it objectively seriously, have very different goals.
Mm-hmm.
The movie side is you're part of the end of the relay race of Oscar season.
Yeah, right.
You're a crucial baton pass. And also, as you were talking about with Michelle Yeoh, there's a chance to spread the wealth a little bit and then maybe an upset can happen because they split the categories into drama and comedy. On the TV side, it is a temperature check. It is what you're describing. It is a version of the Emmys with a different eligibility window. Mm-hmm. So White Lotus is up there that talking about season two already, right?
Yeah, and
there
which are other... felt very of the moment and I thought probably was like a really nice representation of like, this is what people really cared about within the last 6 months of television is the show.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've made this reference before because I did feel like it was a significant moment, but because of where these fall, they can have an outsized impact on how we are not just we're covering TV, but I think how people are engaging with it. And I think about it's now 10 years ago, but Homeland season one premiered in September, I think of 2011. And Claire Danes won Best Actress for that season in January of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, it was an anointing, right? Of a whole new moment in TV. And that is still kind of exciting and should be fun TV to watch. But again, this is just way too many things all at once. It was an apology tour. It was a singing for your supper. Please, Mr. NBC, can we have more money to do this again? It was a half-assed party, you know, like just a lot of people just didn't come. And look, I mean, people in LA will cancel for any reason. The rain was a gift, but this did feel particularly like not everyone was on the same page about whether they wanted to engage with this or not.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I read Matt Bellany's like behind the scenes piece that he sent out in the What I'm Hearing newsletter for Puck. And it was interesting. He said that Gerard's monologue went over pretty well, like that, that there were some laughs and that it was the talk of the room. But at the same time, it felt like Gerard lost the room. Like after that, like that he couldn't, or whatever the situation was like this year in particular, it felt like way more chaotic coming back from break and him being like, hey, Like, oh, we're starting. We're doing it.
I was reading about this too, though, that someone was saying that they hung him out to dry because often there's like a stentorian like announcer voice.
Okay.
Being like, and now we're back to the Golden Globes. And that's the sort of the shush everyone, like lowering the lights in the lobby at intermission. But they didn't do that. So he really was trying to like lasso cats.
Okay.
Drunk, rich celebrity cats in that moment. But just to run through some stuff, I mean, like, again, if you didn't watch the show, which is most of you in America, you may just have looked at the winners and been like, you know, an interesting and not too problematic night in terms of quality, right? Like Jeremy Allen White won for The Bear. Mm-hmm. Did The Bear win? No, but that's awesome. He deserves to win. Abbott Elementary won. Tyler Williams won. Quinta won. As you said, White Lotus won. Amanda Seyfried won. Like, these are worthwhile things. I didn't watch Blackbird, but people who are more plugged in than me said really good things about Paul Walter Hauser's performance. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not really going to argue with any of that. Zendaya, how do you feel about Costner winning from Santa Barbara? Do you feel like that was a nice balm on a night?
He's really good on Yellowstone. It's just one of those things where it took years to get Yellowstone into being taken seriously by the awards, and now Yellowstone sucks. You know what I mean?
It's terrible when that happens.
But that sometimes does happen, where it's like, by the time a show starts getting recognized, it's actually past its prime. Yellowstone doesn't suck, but it's not my favorite season of Yellowstone.
Can I also just give one side note, which is, I think that we as people like to see modesty, empathy, friendship, kindness modeled for us by people we admire, even in the arts. That said, when you were in the audience and you were in like hour five of the Golden Globes and Banshees of Inisherin wins and Martin McDonagh, one of the sharpest tongued dramatists in the world, gets on stage with Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell, two of the most like roguish and charming actors living, and they all hand the mic to the producer, who just says like, it's very nice that we're all friends. We all had a nice time in Ireland together being friends. Barry, Colin, Brendan, of course, and Martin. It is nice that we're all friends.
I don't think you've seen Banshees of Inisherin, but that literally sounds like a character from Banshees of Inisherin.
Right. So, okay. So it was on brand, but you know what I mean? Like, but that objectively was a shitty speech. Like, no offense. I'm happy for him. They did seem like lovely people, but that's not what we want in these award shows. And they can't really control for that. I mean, they've tried to control for that in the past by like, you know, which was the award show recently that like had everyone submit their list so there should just be a chyron of like people's agents so they wouldn't have to say those things.
Oh,
They've tried to correct for that.
Did Soderbergh really do that? Where it was like, here's my team, so you don't have to go through Barry, Zach, Barry, like whoever.
And we're all friends.
Steven, yeah.
We all had a lovely time.
What was I going to say? Oh, Gerard, I thought certainly Gerard and what I would probably imagine is his last hosting gig in a major award ceremony. I thought that there were two performances. I thought there was his monologue, which was very consistent with what his stand-up is like. And it's both intimate and confrontational and interesting, but kind of also was certainly not like, welcome America, get psyched for 3 hours of an award show. It was sort of a side bit. And then the thing that I think has kind of like sort of become the dominant voice of hosting going forward after that was just like Twitter roast jokes that deflate the momentum and enthusiasm for the show afterwards. So it was basically like two separate performances, but I remain a big fan of his. I just don't know if hosting the Golden Globes is like, it's not his life mission, you know?
No. And it's also, I mean, it was a tough assignment. He definitely, and I don't blame him for this, was like, this was a good paycheck.
Yeah.
I hope it was. He deserves it. He deserves the shine. I think he's a genius, especially, you know, doing the thing that he does, which is stand up. There is a case to be made every time there is and I wouldn't call this a misstep because I did think it was bold and he's an interesting choice. And I enjoy, like you said, I enjoyed a lot of what he did. I'm happy he was there. But anytime like one of these shows goes hostless or like, let's have some actors do it, you're just reminded that like actually hosting is a skill. You know, and so having someone who just is a pleasant host can help.
First of all, I just give it to Regina Hall. Second of all, if not her,
she just hosted the Oscars.
I know, but I'm just saying she's really fucking good at it. So just let her rock. And the thing that she did that was really good, to the extent, I don't know whether or not she was like, I have a bit if Kevin Costner wins and I'm going to do this. Or if that was just like, I've had three Chardonnays and now it's like this is what I'm going to say. My favorite hosting, not even hosting, but even like presenters are always people who have that almost improv comedy training to kind of roll with the way things are going. And Anna Gasteyer and Nicole Byer were like the fucking funniest thing of the night. Yeah. It kind of reminded me of like those Will Ferrell, Kristen Wiig. And that's why Tina and Amy are really good too, is because they can kind of come up with stuff both written and also in the moment. But I mean, who gives a shit? It's just an award show. It's certainly not something I'm losing sleep over. It's just my note. You know what I mean? Like, it's just,
yeah, there's really two, and we can keep, you know, we'll keep having these conversations 2-3 times a year. Like, it's kind of just a two track thing. Like, one is, I think they should do a better job making these as TV shows. I just think they, I know it's hard. I know people much smarter and more connected and more Steven Soderbergh than I have tried and with varying degrees of success. But I think what you're saying about who should be on the mic and how often they should be on the mics to keep it moving, to give a sense of consistency, I feel like that's there to be fixed. The secondary point, which is these used to feel like events because there was a larger monoculture and it felt like a celebration that everyone was invited to and was interested in attending.
Yeah.
Those days are gone. And you can't really fix that. So here we are.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems since everything you need is on one suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be. And try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over 2 decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Would you like to talk about Ant-Man, or would you like to talk about Bella Bajaria next?
I want to talk about Ant-Man because I'm passionate about Ant-Man. No, because I have I don't want to go into the multiverse of madness here, but I do have two almost diametrically opposed takes on this.
Okay. This has been, I think there was a teaser for, it's Ant-Man :
Quantumania.
That's it?
Ant-Man and the Wasp : Quantumania.
Just Quantumania, not Into Quantumania, not vibing out to Quantumania, not Quantumania in the quantum of madness. Okay.
Wasn't Quantum the Soulsides label or something? Is that, am I mixing this up?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was like the Dusty Fingers, funk label.
No, he was the closer after Eckersley. see, it's all callbacks on the show today. People love that.
I just want to ask you a serious question. Mm-hmm.
Finally.
I'm not like the biggest Ant-Man guy. You know, I think it's pretty good, but it's like,
that's brave of you. You
have to admit that this is a trilogy. Like I didn't know that we needed to conclude this saga. My question for you is did they just remake the Spider-Man movie? Because in the trailer, it is Scott is big mad that he lost out on 5 years of his daughter's youth, right? He largely has come through the blip, the snap, whatever, all that stuff. He's come through like intact, came out the other side, saved the world, but is mad that his whatever age 20-year-old daughter, he missed out on ages like 12 to 17, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she was recast during those 5 years too. That must be very discombobulating.
And so his response to that is to upset the space-time continuum by entering into a plea agreement with Kang the Conqueror, right?
Yeah, no notes. Seems fine.
Did the people of Sokovia get such a choice? You know, like, I guess we're everybody in the fucking Marvel Universe just gets a do-over, right? Has no one ever been like, what I want to do over is Ultron dropping Sokovia?
Justice for Sokovia?
Yeah. How come nobody is thinking about the bigger picture? Everybody's just like, I'm too famous, or I missed out on my teenage daughter being really nasty to me for 5 years.
Yeah. Good point on that, by the way.
You know what I mean? And instead, nobody's like, you know what we should do is go back and make sure that Sokovia doesn't get dropped on its head.
Yeah. There are weeks when I hear Bill and Sal do Parent Corner where I'm like, they would take this blip. You know what I mean? Like they would blip themselves TF out of those 5 years and just come back as conquering heroes. Do you think the president of Sokovia was invited to Earth 616's Golden Globes?
Sean Penn introduced him.
I do think so. Our fictional country had a great cultural history until your murderous robot dropped us.
But at least the Sokovia Accords have cleaned that all up.
They live on.
Yeah.
There's two answers here. The most obvious one is Marvel didn't make the Spider-Man movie.
I know you know that, but
I feel like they're mad. But also multiverse, like the last two movies have been like, no, but we're doing it now.
Right.
And the Spider-Man movie did it better and did it definitively. So that is a weird position to be in, and that is definitely affecting everything going forward. I think the big question for me is just like anyone who watched, because the Ant-Man movies hold a weird place because it was such a heat check for Feige when he was in his glory, right? Where that only existed during the very, very like Wild West days of the MCU when he was just taking meetings with people and they were like, I want to do this. And he was like, cool, great. So Edgar Wright was like, I want to do Ant-Man. They're like, that's weird. Sure. We're going to announce it. We'll get Paul Rudd. And then Edgar Wright left the project. And then to the pure hubris of like, we're still going to make an Ant-Man movie. Mm-hmm. And then it was a hit. And it was pretty good. Pretty good to the degree that I think some people who don't love the overall, you know, arc of Thanos are like, those movies are fun. I enjoy those movies.
I enjoyed the movies too. Yeah.
So the decision to do the reverse Thor and suddenly make it a heart-rending drama with enormous universal stakes is bizarre. Like, I don't see any evidence of Michael Pena in the Quantumverse, just reciting things that have just happened across the Quantumverse. So that is a weird tonal shift for the movie. My biggest nitpick, if you'll allow me to, from this trailer, and, you know, it's just a small thing. I think most people won't care about this or won't notice. But my main takeaway is that this looks absolutely like shit. Not the movie. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie. I mean, visually, this just feels like the absolute endgame, pun intended, of this, we'll just draw the movie behind you, please come to Atlanta, open-ended ticket. It's just absolute low-grade, 1,000 CGI houses around the world drawing purple stuff. That is a bummer.
It's a weird, isn't it weird to kind of long for the back lots of Atlanta?
Or be like, Justice for Eternals. At least she went to a place. Do you know what I mean? Like, At least
you slowly caping up for Eternals. Yeah. By this time next year, it's going to be the lost classic : Eternals, solo Andy Greenwald podcast.
They're rewatchable only by me. I'm caping up like the great lost Eternal Icarus. If you remember,
I do.
Just kidding. Nobody remembers. I still think about that lonely Eternals Lego set.
I still
set
think
on the
about
shelves.
Being in the Eternals. Did that come out during a COVID wave?
Sure.
I remember being in that theater and being like, this might be the last movie I ever go see in the theater. They may have just like forgotten how to do this.
I
saw Megan last night. So I guess I'm back. You know?
You're back, baby.
I'm back in the theater.
The visual stuff is just a bummer to me because I think the other half of it that is slightly encouraging to me, there's two things. One is big Paul Rudd truther over here. Paul Rudd is a great actor and a great movie star. He's always good. He's never bad. He can do drama and comedy. He's fun to watch. He's great to root for. This might be a smart pivot because we don't have Downey. Downey's not walking through the doors. Evans isn't walking through the doors. I'm not saying he's the same as them. I'm not saying his Q rating is the same, but you do have a great performer who people are emotionally invested in. So give him more to do. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, he's earned the starting slot. It's not a bad idea to sneak in the next phase through him because he's one of the few bridge actors who's still agreeing to be a part of this. I don't know if he's a part of it beyond this movie, but he at least is helping kick in the door to do that. So I like that. The second thing is this entire trailer is a, you know, again, not all of our listeners watch the markets move the way you and I do. You know what I mean? So they might not be accustomed to these kinds of just sort of performative
flexes.
Stay
opening my stock app on my phone. Yeah,
exactly. It's definitely not on the 12th page of apps for me. This is an enormous show of investor confidence in Jonathan Majors.
I will go out. I'm going to say two things. Well, I'm going to say this thing first. I'm out there on the diving board with Jonathan Majors.
Yeah.
And if he goes, I go. You know what I mean?
I love this. Yes.
I'm willing to say that we are on the precipice of and have seen evidence of the most interesting performance and maybe character in the entire MCU.
Yeah, why not? That's right. And we also know from decades of this shit that genre movies live and die on the villains.
Mm-hmm. And they haven't had one in a long time.
Yeah. They haven't had one in a long time. And there's a little bit of the old Feige in this. The like they invested early. I've made this joke before, but it's like these, you know, it's like the Mariners pouring $300 million into I'm kind of blanking on the kid's name, but like their 19-year-old soon to be megastar. They're like, we got one.
Yeah.
And we know we have, and we're building everything around him. And I think that's awesome. So I agree. So he's so compelling. And the choices he's clearly already making are so interesting that all of the CGI space snakes just vanish behind him. And if this is two stage actors, really, shout out to everyone else who saw Paul Rudd in As You Like It or Midsummer Night's
Paul
Dream
Rudd
at Lincoln
stayed
Center.
Up in Neil LaBute plays.
That's what I'm saying. Him and Majors just going tête-à-tête, you know what I mean? Just true westing it somewhere in the quantum realm.
That's
cool.
You should start doing playwright bullshit. Is like when you see
is classic Shepherd.
Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania is serving Sam Shepherd. That should be your new bit vibe.
I'm getting distinct Romulus Linney vibes here, guys, and I am here for it. So it's interesting. The other thing that I think is interesting, just in terms of the way we cover this stuff, is I do appreciate that they are like tap, tap, tap on Mike, clears throat. Okay, we're starting again.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it now. You know, we've had our fun. We all love the Eternals and what a romp that was. But now we're telling you what we're doing, a big one again.
That was, it was definitely a romp for sure.
That's how I choose to remember it.
Screwball comedy. I have a quick question about the visual aspect because we've bagged on the way these things look for better part of 2 years now.
Yeah.
Is it the technology and the conditions under which maybe people are doing VFX? That could be a huge factor. And there's been reporting about like Marvel just has you on these crazy deadlines and then they'll like change everything at the last second and say, no, like put this here and do this differently. Is it that, or is that there, of all the things that the source material provides, these rich stories, these sort of memorable characters. Does it have like much of a concept of space or the quantum verse? Or like, yes. I don't really remember looking through the comic books and being like, I can't wait to see this represented on the big screen.
See, I disagree with you there. I think that the thing
you would
that
know better than I would, yeah.
The thing that set Marvel Comics apart was the absolute what the fuckness visual imagination of its core creators, like Jack Kirby. Like Jack Kirby, who created the Eternals, by the way, drawing these things, drawing the negative zone in Fantastic Four comics. I mean, he was just kind of like a post-war like cigar in mouth and will draw until he drops dead kind of dude. I don't think he was a druggie, but they were mirroring like the 60s counterculture in such a wild way. And then you get to the 70s. And a lot of this, I'm just riffing on stuff that our buddy Sean Howe wrote about in his phenomenal book about Marvel Comics, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Like, by the time you get to the 70s and a lot of the space stuff that James Gunn really brought into the MCU is happening, you have people like Jim Starlin actively taking acid and then writing these comic book scripts. Like, it is cool and it is exciting. And it's increasingly a reminder that maybe comic book art is the best place for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is I think to go back to your original question, it remains unclear to me whether it is a failure of creative visual imagination in those who are responsible for the VFX work these days, or a factor of everyone's just stressed and over, like you just can't do it. Like everyone's under deadline, they change their mind, so everything ends up looking like a silver space wolf.
Yeah,
and that's just where we are.
I don't know. I mean, like the two movies that we've referenced in this conversation is Cyberman Man or The Eternals and Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, and those were directed by two auteurs. You know, Chloe Zhao, yes. Zhao directed Eternals and Sam Raimi directed Doctor Strange. And there are parts of both of those movies that look distinctly like those directors. Like there are moments where I think even in Doctor Strange, like there's like Raimi-esque flourishes in some of the monsters and sort of dream demons that appear in the beginning of that movie. And even in that whole long sequence where it's like in the castle in limbo somewhere, like that's very Sam Raimi. It's like that haunted house vibe.
Yeah. And like when Salma Hayek as the Eternal Ajax shits in a bucket, that is exactly like Nomadland, right?
That's right.
Like that
that's
was
right.
that was incredible.
And I really salute Salma because that was like
brave.
Yeah. But I don't think that the directors that they choose seem to be empowered to like see their vision through that end of the thing. So then what happens is like you wind up getting these kind of like, if you have a movie that is largely taking place in this world, in this sort of sci-fi fake reality, it kind of winds up looking like trash because it gets put together without any authorial vision. I mean, that's maybe, you know, tourist viewing of
it's also a byproduct of the fact that, and we've heard this anecdotally, I'm sure this isn't absolute universal gospel for everything that they do, but we've heard this enough to believe that there's aspects of the story that are true, which is these movies are so expensive and it's so difficult to coordinate and the release dates are so crucial that even as creatives swap in and out, new screenwriters come on, new production designers come on, new directors come on, the action set pieces are already boarded before the people get involved. So then they are writing their story around the four set pieces that have already been designed and have already been sent to various effects houses around the world. Like that's just the nature of these movies. And so it's a bummer. And also there might not be, you know, the same creative participation because on Monday, we were talking a little bit with Sean about Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And Dune is another $200 million big IP genre movie, but it felt absolutely designed and distinct. And honestly, when you see someone's aesthetic vision, even if it's not your own, given the you just admire it. It's almost transcendent. You're like, I just, that's amazing. These dragonfly speedsters in that movie are just the runes on the wall. Like you're in someone's mind, and that's what these things could be. The Marvel movies, I mean, I think even if we ever had someone like Kevin Feige on a podcast, I don't think he'd be like, well, that's apples and we make oranges. Like you just cannot do that. But as Marvel has pushed further and further into the quantum realms, and I mean that broadly, for a number of reasons, we've talked about them before, like it's different stakes. There's less death. There's less real world stuff. It probably plays better internationally. You can just have your actors on set in Atlanta and draw the rest in later. All these reasons, they've gone further and further into the stuff that should be the most creative. And then, you know, we get Taika shooting Christian Bale weeping in a Walmart parking lot, you know, it's just, which I think is actually true, right?
That would have been cool, actually.
If they hadn't CGI'd out the Walmart, that would have been an interesting choice. So that part of it is a huge bummer. And it's also why that, you know, you haven't seen Black Panther yet, right? You haven't seen Wakanda?
I haven't, no.
So if and when you do see it and we do talk about it, I think this is the conversation to have, because I had a lot of problems with that movie, but the cultural and genre world building remains pretty distinct, and they seem to prioritize it in those movies, which is why those movies are better.
I'll definitely see one of the reasons before Ant-Man comes out. You know, I'm a completist when it comes to that stuff.
You are.
Let's talk about this Bella Bajaria piece. It's been a while since we've kind of like run through. I'm not going to do like a line by line reading of this very exhaustive and well done profile that Rachel Syme did in The New Yorker. Bella Bajaria is basically the head of television for Netflix. I'm not sure what her exact title is, but she essentially runs TV for Netflix and replaced Cindy Holland, who had sort of been the original architect of Netflix's television strategy, the one that gave us House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and a lot of the shows that Netflix streaming sort of built its reputation on. And then Bella Bajaria came, I think, from more of a broadcast background, more of a, also is outlined in this show, a very pragmatic executive who was very good at saving shows that were being kind of neglected by the networks that were originally broadcasting them.
She was the head of Universal Television, the studio, meaning that, you know, she was basically when this is the short version of, hopefully short version of this is, as rules changed about who could produce shows and what studios could make shows for what. And so all these networks and then eventually streaming services created their own or resurrected their own in-house studios. She was tapped to lead Universal Television Group, and then Universal immediately had signed all of its successful creators to overall deals. People like Michael Schur coming off of The Office before Parks and Rec, Mindy Kaling, many more shows than that. I mean, like all the Law and Order shows come out of Universal Television. So she was in charge of that studio. And to your point, yes, like when NBC didn't buy Mindy Project or Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she turned around and sold them to Fox.
Yeah.
So she was, that was both canny and pragmatic, and she had good relationships with a lot of talented creators that we admire.
So this piece, I think, I wanted to ask you this question to start with. So I encourage everybody to read it. I think what it really gives you, if you're like an avid watch listener, I'm sure you kind of have a sense of the story of Netflix from this piece. There's a lot of personal details about Bella Bajaria that are quite interesting, biographical details. What's amazing is the level of access that Rachel got, where she is essentially like in meetings, at lunches, going through the world.
On private jets.
On private jets, yeah, right. And I wanted to ask you this, put your creative cap on, like your I still make TV cap on. Do you read this piece and come out of it being like, that's a pretty savvy operator? And if I had a show that I thought like had the potential to be successful, I still think Netflix gives me the opportunity to get in front of the most eyeballs across the world at once. Or does it send a chill down your spine and make you think that like TV is moving fully into its flop phase, where it's just like everything is buzzwords and the idea of like maintaining relationships and fostering creativity is kind of a thing of the past?
It is the question coming out of this story. I have to say, I kind of zagged on it. I think the story is interesting and interestingly reported and written, and it does feel that it is really set up to make that narrative the winner, the narrative that this woman is interesting and savvy, but as another person anonymously says in the piece, not an intellectual, and is going around the world glad-handing, dumbing everything down in the process. And there's a lot of like sort of, you know, juicy details, like speaking to Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix. He's speaking from his 17-acre compound in Montecito. You know, again, prayers up. I hope that the irrigation ditches worked over the past week up there for him. It was hard, though, for me to read this and feel like anything other than the fact that she's doing a very good job at her job.
Mm-hmm.
And her job is primarily to fly to Mexico City and be like, what shows are we making that are popping here? Great. Can we export the shows that are popping here to Egypt? Because we have a lot of new talent deals there. Can we bring them over here? Can we work with you? Can we build this? And it's not just that she's making The Floor is Lava in 64 countries. She is also making All the Light We Cannot See, an adaptation of the award-winning novel with Mark Ruffalo and Sean Levy directing in Budapest right now. Like, so there's stuff happening. There's stuff that's clicking. There's stuff, you know, that I think she's happy to take credit for that is even like critically lauded. My main takeaway was it's just, this is a profile of a woman who is very successful in a very specific business, and that business doesn't align with what you and I want to watch on Sunday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. I think what's bizarre to me on like on a macro level is, so in the story, as Chris said, they basically are, Rachel Syme sort of narrates the story that we've been telling to a degree, which is Cindy Holland was head of programming for Netflix and made the deals that got the Emmy voters' attention, that brought talent like Raphael Bob Waksberg, who did BoJack Horseman, is quoted extensively being like, this was home, this was family, they Fincher, took a chance on me.
Yeah.
Then they stopped knowing the names of the characters on my show and I knew we were done. And Ted Sarandos, basically in a move worthy of season one of the Golden Globe winning drama series House of the Dragon, was like, actually, you're the heir to my throne after all that, to Bela Bajaria, and removing Cindy Holland and saying like, you, Bela Bajaria, who came up with Nailed It and Flora's Lava and all this stuff, you're going to run around the world and make us what we're going to become. And what we're going to become is broadly television.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I read the story more than anything else was, and you know, there are juicy details like demanding that Rachel Syme doesn't, Bela Bajaria on a private plane being like, don't write that I like Chardonnay, or stuff like wearing a pin that says like, what is it, like everything for art or whatever, while she's leading a 24-hour taco crawl in Mexico City, which, by the way, Bella, let's do it. We've really fucked up, because if the goal is a system where there's a lot of stuff and some of it's schlocky and most of it's sticky and some of it's entertaining and a little bit of it is actually really, really high quality and good, and the first stuff subsidizes the second stuff, guys, we had that. That was television.
Yeah.
That's literally what this medium was for 40 or 50 years. And then we burned it down in the name of shareholder growth and streaming opportunities. And now we're mad because they're doing it again. Broadly, that was confusing for me, you know, because I do think that they should be making better shows. And I think the big sin seems to be that in their desire to become a global company, they seem to have neglected the American.
Yeah. They've also, like, I think, audience. Started to have a little bit more of a rigid, it's either hit or it's shit binary, where like,
yes,
they
sure.
either have something that it's like, if this isn't popping, I don't really care how much money we spent on it or how much we believe in the totality of the project. But 1899 is a perfectly good example of a show that maybe even you and I didn't think worked in its first season, but given the track record of the creators and the success of Dark, at least creatively, like, you'd think that maybe they'd be like, if we're going to go into this project, we need to know that it's not going to get wrapped up in 10 hours.
That's a great point.
They need to
invest in the things that, if you believe in something, believe in it.
Right.
I think that matters.
But
sure.
There is something kind of, and we were getting on in this pod. I don't want to go into 1,000 different tangents, but this whole article really made me think a lot about Steven Soderbergh's media diary that he publishes beginning of every year about the previous year. And he just released his 2022 one this year. And I usually go through it and I'll make, like, especially with the movies, I'll just write down every movie that he watched, because I find that he has a lot of really great, like, kind of, especially sub Turner Classic Movies level old Hollywood films to watch. Usually like noir movies to watch from that 40s and 50s era that I haven't seen or haven't even heard of. But the fun part about his list is it's like literary fiction, watching Sorcerer 7 times, watching David Fincher's not yet released The Killer 7 times in a week or whatever. And then literally hundreds of hours of shit TV, not shit TV, but just like,
a lot of Bravo.
He watched a lot of Below Deck. He watched Cheer. And I sometimes try to derive like a unifying theory of Soderbergh out of these lists. And so I was going through all the shows he was watching, and so many of them are like Catching Killers and, you know, mm-hmm. these true crime. And I realized he's just going through the true crime documentary tab of Netflix. Like, I just pulled that up and it's just, he's just watching them pretty much in not order, but like whatever picks his fan. And like, that's called watching television. That's called, like, I got home at 5. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was turn on SportsCenter in the background so that there was a voice in the house while I made dinner, you know? And maybe it's a slightly more active, or as John Landgraf would say, leaning in engagement than that. Like, I'm sure Steven Soderbergh just likes true crime and it's just like, I'll watch a 37-minute documentary about the BTK guy. But this is what they're making. They're making TV. They're not making a new step forward in long-form narrative screened culture, right?
Yeah. Yes, and that's okay.
Sure.
That's okay. I think we got... These last 10 years were very confusing, I think, in many, many ways for us, individually and collectively. And we... I don't know if she's quoting Matt Bellany, who is quoted in the piece, or someone else talking about like how a market correction is coming. I think a market in the industry, and we've been talking about that as well, a market correction might also be coming for our expectations.
Yep.
Where the majority of things being made, there was a moment when it just seemed like everything was a major A-list star combining with a killer script with a brilliant idea, and HBO/Netflix/Apple/Amazon is going to pour $200 million into it. And that was cool. You know, it was great to be eating at a 3-star Michelin restaurant on our TV every night or have that option. But it's a little rich in all senses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not sustainable. Now, you know, I wish there were more risk-taking, and I understand to a degree, I try to have some compassion as to why there's not, and I do think the tech mentality or the global expansion mentality can run contra to that, that purely like, we believe in you and we're going to give this a shot. I did think it was interesting that among the successes of recent Netflix, Queen's Gambit is mentioned, and mm-hmm. everything that we have heard, both on the record and off the record, is that Netflix is like, why are we spending money on this chess show? I don't know who greenlit this, but I don't know if those people are still here, but this isn't what we do. And then it is a huge success and is incredibly compelling to millions of people around the world and wins awards. And that type of thing seems to have been iterated out of the Netflix development algorithm, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that, you know, again, as Rachel Stein points out in the piece, like the Tim Robinson show is on Netflix. I Think You Should Leave is still on Netflix. Like there are these things that exist.
I mean, Squid Game cost $21 million, so it wasn't exactly like a John Cassavetes movie, but Squid Game can still happen. And I think within ecosystem of Netflix, you might see, look, all those Nordy crime, like those Scandi crime shows that they have, like I'm sure there are some that are better than others. I've watched some and been like, that was pretty good, and watched some of them and like, this was just inane drone shots of snow while we find the killer that we knew it was going to be for like 4 episodes. Like, I think that there's a variation of quality depending within those subsections of Netflix, but I don't know.
I think for the last few weeks, if not months, we've found ourselves in these sort of conversational cul-de-sacs where I end up saying something like, oh, I feel weird advocating the business side or over-representing the business side when we want to be talking about art and culture. I think maybe the answer is there's too much business side in our art and culture in TV at the moment, which isn't to say it's not always a business and yada, 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 but everyone is so fucking scared right now of whatever market correction or recession or whatever, or consolidation is coming, that it feels like no decisions are free of that anymore. Like there is no just sort of gentle supportive ecosystem like the one that told Donald Glover, we want to make a show with you, and we want you to have a writer's room. And he's like, no, I'm going to get my friends and we're going to rent a house for 6 months. And they say, cool. Like, actually, FX probably still would do that. But do you know what I mean? Like that kind of ecosystem that just lets weird things happen, lets idiosyncratic visions develop. Everything feels at this moment like it's being developed through the scrim of, well, what world are we putting it out into? And what's it going to mean to my bottom line or my career, you know, future if I do this?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like... I think that's true for the second season of Somebody Somewhere, and I think it's true for the second season of House of the Dragon. And I think it's a bummer for both. And that's, I feel like, more of where we're at with things. It's starting to get... The McDLT isn't keeping the two sides apart anymore, that brilliant box. I feel like the hot side and the cold side of the industry, like the artistry and passion and the cold numbers game, which need each other, are getting a little, everything's getting a little lukewarm.
I wonder also, and I often think this about the conversations that we have, where it's like, if there's so much difference, if there's so many offerings available to people at literally the touch of a finger, where you can just find 10 shows that satisfy a sub genre mm-hmm. personal algorithm itch that you want to scratch, it's harder and harder to say, these are the 5 shows that we're talking about, or the 2 shows that we're talking about, mm-hmm. which is what it was like when we started this podcast 10 10 years ago, 11 years ago, we could just be like, there are like basically seven shows.
Per Bill's tweet watch. 11 years ago.
Yeah, but there is basically like seven shows that people watch this year that also listen to this podcast, and we can go through these episode by episode. And all jokes aside, I think it's more difficult to do that now when there are seven shows a week that you could feasibly check out, if not enjoy, but they get wiped off the table as soon as the next week's shows come along, and you're waiting for the tidal wave coming off of Last of Us, and you're waiting for Poker Face, and you're, you know, all this other stuff that happens. It's really difficult to just be the generic TV watcher.
And what is the, from a business perspective and a corporate perspective, what is the end game and goal here? Because Netflix and Bela Bajaria have been ruthlessly successful. You know, I'm not even going to like couch it in a negative word. They've just been successful in enacting a business plan that they put into effect before we even realized it was happening.
I still think if anybody gets a professional sports live contract, like the whole thing changes. I still think that's essentially the skeleton key that still remains.
You don't think the SAG Awards are going to push them over the edge?
No, like I'm serious. I think if one of these people get the Sunday ticket, or if one of these networks or streamers gets the Sunday ticket or gets League Pass.
But didn't YouTube get it?
Yeah, but like that's not like a programming offering, I guess. Right. But like if Apple were to get League Pass, or if Netflix were to get something, like it would be a big deal, because that's when you start seeing people be like, I really don't need cable anymore.
But I think that Netflix's goal was different. Well, there's two things. There's a quote that's brilliant that I'm sure has been said and bandied about for years that I'd never noticed, which was, I don't know if it was Reed Hastings or Ted Sarandos at Netflix saying when they did House of Cards, this timeline was new to me as revealed in this article, that they bought House of Cards and then acquired Lilyhammer to go out first as a proof of concept, like test their ability to do this and to dump something all at once and what it would be like. So that's actually, House of Cards really was the first, even though everyone's like, no, don't forget Lilyhammer. Lilyhammer aired first, but it existed because of House of Cards. But anyway, the quote from that time was, our goal as a company is to become HBO before HBO can become us. And that is really smart at that moment in time, 10 years ago. And it kind of worked. No, it definitively worked for a time. And now nobody's anybody, but that's where we're at. But my point about what Bell has been doing around the world is been successful. Like, we are going to seed this idea of production in dozens of countries and create must-see glut, that there's just always something more for you, that you feel the need to service, to have the service in your life. And we're going to replicate this around the world. And every so often, one of those things, like Squid Game, will jump its silo and become a thing everywhere, and that's going to work. My question is, and this is maybe the question of the industry, is, but then what? Like, in this piece, it's like, well, they lost $500 million in value in one day when they didn't meet their latest earnings thing, but they're still spending $17 billion a year on content all around the world. They're just going to keep doing this. So, maybe this is a question of capitalism, not Netflix, but what is the goal here? Is the goal to like make some good shows and be in the awards conversation and kiss your kids and put them to bed at night? Or is your goal just to eat an entire sector forever?
I guess that's
the goal.
Because that's also like, they don't have like even, there's nothing like with the ESPN story, for instance, where it's just like ESPN is eating off these carriage fees for decades. They have these sports rights, these live sports rights, which are still like, no matter what you put on between these games, people want to watch games. And I don't think Netflix just has the subscriber fee and they're going to start this ad supported tier or whatever. But like, there's no way that this is like a profitable business unless there isn't something else, you know, like there's no way Netflix becomes profitable unless it becomes the thing you do is you get an internet subscription from your cable provider and then you just have Netflix up on your television. They don't sell hardware. They don't sell advertising.
They don't have a theme park.
Yeah.
They don't have cruises. I think it's funny now to think about, and I'm sure this was in the Jim Miller book. I don't mean to say that he didn't like actually focus on this or reference it. But if you think about the what's it called? Those guys have all the fun, the ESPN oral history book. It's a great read, really interesting. It's not that complicated a story, right? There was an opening and people like to watch sports. And it got carriage fees, meaning ESPN got millions of dollars a year, whether you watch it or not, because everyone subscribed to cable. And so then the interesting things in the book are generally about what happened in between receiving the checks and then cutting half of them back for the sports leagues, right? Like the largesse of the carriage fees is what allowed them to do things like 30 for 30 or the commercials we all laughed and liked or the ESPYs or whatever, like the interesting stuff in the margins, it was subsidized.
Yeah.
Right? It was subsidized. And so now we've cut the cord. Good job by us. And everybody's got to sing for their supper, whether it's like, you know, whether it's The Wire or whether it's Floor is Lava, and more people like Floor is Lava. So, hello. Let's do here's the next 11 years.
Did you want to do Daddington?
I don't even know if we have time. I think what I wanted to do, maybe we should prepare more for it, but because I was feeling like, you know, there are a lot of great unanswered questions on this podcast. Like, what was my theory about Octung Baby that I teased 6 years ago and never revisited?
Did you never actually say what it was?
No.
Oh.
Nor will I ever. Maybe on our 21st.
Will you ever say what you thought of Fablemans?
Yeah, that one, I can't. I'm waiting on you.
Okay.
I'm not being secretive about the fact that
I'm sorry. I got
really disliked it.
I had to go see Megan instead.
I'm so disappointed in you. It's my cousin Megan Fableman.
I wish I was part of the Fablemans universe.
There's a world where we could. No, I just did a drive-by on Puss in Boots. It was mostly about drinking beer in a movie theater in the middle of the day. And it made me think, like, the reason I didn't like it is because it was just more noisy, shouting kids' entertainment that I didn't think had much value. I mean, my kids liked it. It wasn't objectionable.
But were
it was
people
fine.
Like, why do you hate Puss in Boots?
Yeah, like, it has a high cinema score rating. And, like, I enjoyed it with my kids. Like, yeah, if the kids like it, then it's pretty much good. Like,
what if my
it's a
kids
good
enjoyed
it? What if one of my kids is Megan? Would she enjoy it? But so my point was just that it was really noisy and I didn't think it was very good beyond what it was. And then it made me think, like, how to bring you into this conversation.
Thanks.
It may be from the perspective of a Kiddington being like, well, wait, what were we watching that was so good? And so we could punt this to Monday, because I was trying to think about, like, there's just so much more entertainment now that when I'm thinking about being nine, like my older daughter is, I'm like, okay, well, The Karate Kid came out when I was seven, like Back to the Future when we were eight. Like, these are movies that we watched. But also, I remember it was a big deal to go see Splash in the theater. Okay. Mm-hmm. Splash begins with John Candy dropping change to look up the skirts of women. Like, what I'm realizing is there was no kids' entertainment. There was just a couple things. All of them were inappropriate. And it's a wonder. It's just a wonder we are who we are. Or maybe it's not a wonder.
Yeah.
So,
We could save it. I have lots of anecdotes about inappropriate things that I watched when I was probably 9 years old.
Yeah, let's do a more extended Daddington and Kiddington retrospective, because I do want to, like, be honest and forthright with our audience first and foremost, but also, like, I do think this needs some context, because I am definitely up on Snob Hill being like, well, this wasn't Miyazaki worthy. And it's just like, I didn't know who Miyazaki was until like 6 years ago.
Does your daughter enjoy that take?
God, I really hope not.
Do they detect your vibe coming off the skin contact high that you have of, like, whether you like something or not? You do?
Yes. I try not to, but they know that Bluey is a good one. You know, they know the Miyazaki movies are good. But I'm faking it more with music, where if they bring in something, I'm like, that's fun. Oh, boy, that's snappy. That's
and then
good.
When you hear that song for the 10,314th time in 2 weeks, how do you feel about it?
Well, mostly I focus on the taste of copper in my mouth, because I've just ground my tongue to dust.
Your slow disassociation. That's been happening.
Yeah, it's fine. Guys, everything's fine.
Thanks to our Megan, Kaya McMullen, for producing this podcast.
Classic Megan. The classic Megan.
We'll be back, I think, on Monday. I'm pretty sure. We're going to talk about Last of Us, whether it's Monday or Tuesday. It's TBD.
Oh. All right. Do you want to do a scheduling call now that we're all in the Zoom, or should we end the podcast?
It's Martin Luther King Day. You know?
Yeah, so I was going to observe the holiday. Chris.
By talking about The Last of Us?
By reserving my thoughts until Tuesday. But, you know, we could do this off air.
Okay.
Justice for Montecito.
Stay dry, Branskis.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.